Hello, Portland Trailblazers fans, and welcome to NBA Christmas. There is only one day in the entire year that is better than this one. That's when your team makes the playoffs and plays game number one. That will not happen until next April, but right now, today, October 25th, it is opening day of the Portland Trailblazers season. They will face the Utah Jazz tonight. Here to talk about that and many other things, I'm Dave Deckard, managing editor of Blazers Edge, along with our podcast guru and all-around good and handsome guy, Dan Morang. Dan, how are you feeling today?
I am doing fantastic, and now I'm handsome, so we'll go ahead and go with that. You know, this is, it's no more dog days, it's no more hype, there's no more let's get ready, it's full-on WWE, let's get ready to rumble, let's, you know, release the hounds and see what we got. 82 games, and, you know, this is the opening gate, and this is what we all kind of get ready for.
It's not dog days, it's cat days. Meow. I am just overjoyed that we are finally here after a long, long summer that began with disappointment of a sort and, you know, kind of resolved to where I think most people are content enough to see what's going to happen. Well, we're finally going to see what's going to happen tonight. The Blazers and Jazz, what do you got for this game?
You know, we've seen the Jazz already a couple times in the postseason, and we've discussed
preseason. We may see them yet in the postseason as well. We'll have the prediction part later.
Preseason. But we've also talked about them and how they stack up against the others in the Western Conference, and particularly the Portland Trailblazers. Well, things have kind of changed a little bit, not so much for the Jazz, because they had a ton of injuries last year, and they're heading into this game with a ton of injuries again. We're talking about missing Boris Diaw, missing Derek Favors. Gordon Hayward's out for a significant amount of time. So they're all out of the gate. They're limping into game one, and this is a game that Portland has to have when you look at it and you want to start your season right and you're facing an opponent that's in your division and you want to get off to the on the right foot.
Well, that's absolutely an underrated point. We'll get back to the injuries in a second, but I'm going to be interviewed later today on the Blazers pregame show, as far as I know. And one of the things that we're going to talk about is that every game counts this season, even more so than normal, because in the Western Conference, you have maybe 1.5 teams at the top, and everything else is a pretty level playing field. So the Blazers can legitimately talk about fighting for tiebreakers in game one. And with the Jazz injured, as you said, Hayward is out. Alec Burks, of course, is out. Dia and Favors are questionable. Rodney Hood is a little bit injured as a sprained hand, is expected to play. This, according to basketballreference.com, already misfortune seems to be tailing this Utah team.
Yeah, you know, as much as I'm a Blazers fan and I love this team to death, I'd like to see the Jazz, other than the Lakers, seem like a natural rival for the Blazers. So I want to see both these teams at full strength going head-to-head. You know, you get the matchups that across the board that really look good, and you've got so many guys on the other side of the ball that are nicked up. But that's the nature of the beast. So as the Blazers come into this game, you would fully expect them to understand what's at stake right out of the gate. And 46.5 wins is what Vegas picked us. So that's 20 wins more than last year. So you're not really sneaking up on anybody. On top of that, you've got some people that think the Blazers are going to finish above that, and some people who think they're going to finish below that. And much like last year with the Blazers, how they started off against the Pelicans so well, if you start off well, you give yourself a little bit of leeway going forward.
Absolutely. So now, even with all those injuries, the Jazz field some fairly good players. Break it down in the backcourt for us. Who do the Blazers maybe have to fear?
George Hill is a guy who I think was one of the best pickups in the offseason for any team across the league, save Kevin Durant. George Hill is a two-way point guard. He can shoot. He can create off the bounce. He can get to the rim, plays defense. He's just a good, solid player. If he's on your team and he's a starter and he's your fourth or fifth best player, you're doing really well. In the Jazz, when fully healthy, he's their fourth or fifth best player. You pair that with a guy like Rodney Hood, who is really kind of emerged or is emerging as a knockdown shooter. He's to me, he's a more advanced version of Allen Crabbe, a little bit bigger. puts the ball on the floor slightly better, but he's that same kind of role for them, stretches the defense. He's not a guy you can leave really open from anywhere, so those two guys can really lead the attack. But I know you want to talk about the big men, so go ahead and take it from here, Dave.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say that Hood scares me a little bit, but the guy who makes the Jazz really scary. I mean, it's not that he's the guy. Derek Favors is really more of the guy in the front court. But when the Jazz have great games from Rudy Gobert, that's when they really excel. And of course, that guy is scary. He's over 7 feet tall. He's just a monster in terms of his ability to affect the space around him. His problem is mobility. I mean, he can't move far enough to extend that space. And in this way, I think the Blazers have a natural advantage over the Jazz, no matter who suits up for them, because Portland's guards, in particular Damian Lillard, have Rudy Gobert's number, I mean, so badly that they're like crank calling him at 3 a.m. I mean, that's just, they have him on speed dial because they just get past him. I mean, if he takes even half a step toward them, they're underneath his arms, underneath the rim, putting up a layup or a reverse layup and scoring two on him. He just cannot catch up to them. I think that's going to be a problem for Gobert. I think that's going to be a problem if they have to play Joe Johnson, who is another guy that they got. I mean, this guy is like dinosaur old, and it's not like he doesn't have game, but he's not going to move around and defend. Who are you going to put him on? I mean, you going to put him on Mo Harkless? No. You going to put him on CJ McCollum? Heck no. I think the Blazers basically in some ways neutralize both of those players if they move at all, and if they can keep Gobert from getting 800 offensive rebounds and putbacks, I don't see them having much trouble winning this game.
Yeah, you know, you kind of hit on it there in the end, is that Gobert is an unbelievable defensive player. The amount of space that he can negate is really impressive. But like you touched on, Damian Lillard has his number. I mean, he gets into his body. He creates separation. And unbelievably, Lillard is a good finisher inside. But when he sees Rudy Gobert, he turns into an elite finisher inside. I don't really understand it. The guy's one of the best interior defenders in the league. And that's the guy that Lillard roasts frequently.
It's a video game. He like goes into slow-mo time. You know, that version in FPSs where you can hit a button and everything slows down.
You get those quick time animations, man. Yeah, you gotta love them.
Exactly. And that's how Lillard sees Gobert moving around. I mean, Gobert is the guy that you would like to have when the Blazers had Robin Lopez. Not that Lopez wasn't good, but Gobert is like the ultimate that kind of guy.
He's an ice defender that will take away the paint no matter
what.
He's
a glacier. I mean, there's so much ice on that that it's like global warming may make him quicker, but that's about the only thing that will. In any case, yeah, I think, you know, the Jazz have a scary lineup. The Jazz could well finish ahead of the Blazers in the division and the conference, but the Blazers have a couple things that the Jazz just can't cope with. Now, the danger, I think, if we go back to the backcourt, is that the Jazz also have a couple players. I mean, you know, Trey Burke could turn out to be pretty decent.
Trey Lyles. Burke's on his way in
sorry,
Detroit
yeah,
now.
Sorry. Yeah, that's what I mean. And he's a front court player.
He's a guy that really the Jazz are gonna slot in. I mean, yeah, especially with these injuries early on, I wouldn't be surprised to see Lyles get minutes at the three. And he is not the most swift-footed three on the face of the planet because he's larger. But that also presents problems for Portland. If Portland decides to go small, Utah can still go really big, and they still want to dictate pace and tempo, and controlling the boards is a huge thing for them. As much as Gobert is glacial in a sense, he still, even in the preseason last year, he dictated the boards. I mean, Mason Plumlee, for all of his gifts, guys that are that big and that long, they bother him. So that's something Portland really has to be aware of. If Utah's going to sneak into this game at all, that's their way in, controlling the boards on both ends of the floor. And Portland can get in and run the score. I have no doubt about that. But they have got to control the backboards.
Yes. Now let's try this again. Alec Burks, who is not playing, I think can make a difference. Dante Exum maybe as well. And you already mentioned Rodney Hood. If those guys really got on a roll, against the Blazers, maybe not in this game, but during the season. That's another way. I mean, if Portland's guards can't contain at all, and basically the two backcourts play to a standstill, now Utah has an advantage. But I expect McCollum and Lillard and company to edge out Utah's current backcourt, especially without Hayward. And that's going to make enough difference that the front court won't be able to make it up. So I think we're chalking up a win in game one, especially being at home with all these Utah injuries.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially the way we came out of preseason, I think the guys that really need to excel in this game, particularly Lillard and McCollum, Lillard really took the preseason by storm and looked prime coming through it. McCollum took a little while to warm up, but he seems to have found a little bit of a groove. He's not prime CJ that we saw, you know, closing the season last year. But those two guys are the guys that I obviously are going to have to carry the load this season, and they look good going forward. Guys like Aminu and Harkless have shown brilliant flashes at times, getting hot from outside, decent defense, getting after it. I mean, that's what we're looking at now, is Harkless and Aminu both starting. That's what it Stoss has announced is going to be the starting lineup. So coming out of the preseason, I think the Blazers did well. They're healthy. They had a couple of issues, particularly defensively, but offensively, the first unit looked very, very good at times, and I think that bodes well for them going forward.
Yeah, confidence is high. I think confidence is as high as we've seen it at any time, except maybe, you know, in the year, ironically, when the Blazers fell apart with LaMarcus Aldridge getting injured, Wesley Matthews getting injured. I think the beginning of that year, the confidence might have been slightly more merited, but they're getting really close coming out of this preseason. I don't think we've seen the likes of it for quite some time. Defensive wrinkles, do you think much will change?
We've seen a little bit of it already. Portland's extending their defense. They're getting out and pressuring the ball a little bit more, and it's led to a few more open chances. We've noticed a lot of fouls. Mason Plumlee has fouled out. Ed Davis has fouled out. Coach Stotts has put a emphasis on being more physical, but also getting less fouls. And so far, that hasn't really worked out. So that's going to be an interesting side note to see how that kind of develops. Does Coach Stotts allow them to keep being physical and put pressure on the ball and put pressure on ball screeners? Or do they revert back to a more conservative defense just to keep the fouls down? So how that goes is still kind of...
Yeah, you cannot teach physical. I mean, there are some people who have it and can get away with it, and there's some people who can't. And I think a lot of the Blazers are on the can't list. The advantage that they have is they do have a certain amount of depth in the front court, especially if guys like Noah Vonleh are playing well enough to get a few minutes, then that eases stuff out. But eases stuff up, I should say. But the thing is, NBA referees won't call a lot of fouls on guards. I mean, I think they're going to let star guards play, but guys like reside in Portland's front court, they will foul them out without thinking. If DeAndre Jordan picks up the number of fouls he does, you can bet Ed Davis and Mason Plumlee and Al-Farouq Aminu will pick up fouls. They have no remorse.
Yeah, that's kind of a weird thing. It's when you come into the NBA, if you establish yourself early on as a physical defender and the refs allow it, you can get away with it pretty much your entire career. You take a look at a guy like Andrew Bogut or Steven Adams, guys that are incredibly physical, they grab you, they push you, and they don't really rack up fouls. And that's because from day one they got in the league, they established that. Normally you don't see guys 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years down the road change that, and the refs allowed for that to happen. And I think
they get Mark Bryanted. Bryant.
Exactly.
Still remember that. Like, this guy's going to be great. Oh, no. 12 fouls a game for his entire career. The other part of that, too, is since the Blazers are extending their big men a little bit more, they're not allowed to foul out in the perimeter. Big men will lose every call out there. And so, you know, what they might be able to get away with inside, they're going to be exposed out there. I think it might be an issue. We'll see. You can already tell, folks, that we're incredibly excited. We've mispronounced at least 12 words in the opening 20 minutes. Here we go. Let's try for the next 20, and we'll try to improve our diction here on opening day. Any big preseason revelations outside of the defense that we discussed? What struck you most? Anybody surprise you?
Oh, my goodness. I can't believe I'm saying this. Noah Vonleh. Noah Vonleh, watching him at Summer League was depressing. I mean, I talked to him post-game, and you could see his mind, how he wanted to work on certain things, and it just wasn't coming together for the guy. And he's had some absolutely stellar play so far in the preseason. And not just the comeback where he hit the five straight shots and led it back against Phoenix. He's been very, very physical. He's been on the boards. He's knocked down shots. He had an open three last game where he stepped back into it and then, for whatever reason, decided, I'm just going to kick a leg out and fade, and buried it. And you see the evolution. And the one thing we've talked about, you know, gifting somebody, give Noah Vonleh one go-to move. Well, folks, it looks like he has a go-to move. He backed Kevin Durant down and said, I'm going to go to this baby hook, and either I'm going to get it off or you're going to foul me. Durant fouled him. And it was really impressive. He didn't back down from the moment at all. And that's probably been my biggest criticism of Vonleh since he got here, is that he seemed to shy away from the moment. Now he's like, okay, I've got this one move. You know it's coming. I know it's coming. And there's nothing you can do about it.
The light switch turns on for the man. That would be some exciting stuff, because we've always argued that he's one light bulb away, and it's never lit. Well, I mean, it may have a dimmer on it.
It's got a little flicker to it.
The regular season, you know, is different. But that could be quite an asset coming off the bench if he can develop some reliable offensive moves that will keep him on the court for even 8 minutes, even 10 minutes reliably and productively. Plus also, you know, asterisk hashtag defense. He got lost plenty last year to the frustration of himself, I'm sure, and teammates alike. If he keeps his head on the other end and has, you know, he doesn't need to score 10 points in 10 minutes. If he can threaten 4 points in 10 minutes, he'll probably be ahead.
Yeah, just being another threat on the floor, when you can put a front court player on there that can stretch out to three and post up, that's a very, very difficult thing to deal with. Even if he's third, fourth, or fifth on your pecking list, as far as like threats that you're worried about defensively, just the gravity that he has, you can't sag off that far. You can't cover in the paint. And we actually saw Noah Vonleh and Myers Leonard on the court together, which was a travesty at times last year, where it worked against the Warriors. They actually ran out there together, and I was on Twitter. I'm like, the Vonleh Leonard backcourt pairing is working. Like, they're rebounding. They're shutting down the paint. They're getting down on shooters. This is kind of nice. And granted, it's only for a couple minute spell, but those are the kind of things we often talk about when one thing leads to another. And to me, Vonleh is a big one going into this. Shabazz Napier is another guy that I wrote about. He's a better Tim Frazier. He's better than just insurance for Portland. He's a guy that could come in. He gives you the defensive intensity. You hear Lillard and McCollum talk about how intense he is defensively in practice and how much he makes them get after it. And that really bodes well for Portland, because if that's even remotely contagious at all, he's a guy that can come in for a couple minutes a night and really change things up. He can bring the energy. It's one thing to have an energy guy at the bigs. It's nice to have an energy guy with the smalls too, because that's contagious.
Well, I mean, the question is, if Napier's getting minutes, who isn't? I mean, because the Blazers, in my mind, are semi-committing to run three guards at some point, as long, considering Evan Turner as a guard and Alan Crabb as a guard. I had perhaps envisioned Lillard or McCollum going out for a rest, and Crabb and Turner running together with the remaining star. Now, if Napier's in there, who's not playing?
And that's the thing, is that Coach Stott still really hasn't narrowed down, I don't think, his rotation. And part of that has to do with the guy you touched on, and Evan Turner. He has not looked that great in coming out of preseason. I mean, this last game, he's 0 for 8, 3 turnovers. I mean, there's times on the floor where you can tell he's not familiar with his teammates. And I get that, and that's going to come with time. But there's times where the simple play is there to be made, and he's not making it. I mean, there's one time against the Warriors where he has a wide-open three, nobody around him for 20 feet. He dribbles into the defender and ends up losing the ball. And those things, that's not, you know, lack of familiarity with the scheme or the offense. That's on Evan Turner. So that
yeah, he's going to come around, though. He's going to come around. I mean, I believe I've watched Evan Turner for a while now. There was a time when I kind of coveted him, not so much this summer, but there, once upon a time for a different team, I thought he might have fit reasonably well. And I think that that part of it's rust, part of it's just nerves and whether I should take this shot in this system or, you know, he'll get used to that. And the Blazers, I think, make it easy to play with them, as does their coach. But the thing I have is, okay, Turner needs the ball and McCollum needs the ball and Lillard needs the ball. And Napier may not need the ball in order to defend, but he is, at least in theory, a point guard and probably is comfortable running the offense.
And offensively, he needs the ball. He is not a true blue playmaking contributor. If you watch him during the preseason, he averaged less than an assist a game, but he knocked down shots, which is why I see him as being a guy that you could put out there with an Evan Turner. So I think that's part of the thing that we're looking at and how fluid that situation breaks out.
Right. And well, and granted, the Blazers needed another ball handler more or less to balance Allen Crabbe, because Crabbe is not entirely a ball handler. And I'm kind of being kind there. And of course, Al-Farouq Aminu is not any kind of a ball handler. That was Aminu handling the ball was the equivalent of Wesley Matthews, like on the break at certain points, like, no, no, no. You just start yelling, don't do it. But you know, Turner could contribute that way. But then now, if you have Turner and Napier, then are both Lillard and McCollum sitting? And is both of them sitting ever going to be good for this lineup?
Yeah, and that's honestly a good question. And it's not one I have a ready-made answer for. But I think it's something where, at times, Lillard and McCollum feel like they're being overused. And that's not necessarily against Coach Stotts. It's
there's the next dozen mispronunciations.
Yeah, exactly. Coach Scott, yeah, you know.
Yeah, him. Scott. Yeah, Byron Scott? No.
Yeah,
okay.
But yeah, it's to me, it's a good problem to have. If you've got a guy who looks like he could get minutes and he's not getting on the floor, that means you've got reliable depth behind you. And if a guy like McCollum can give up a couple minutes and save him, I mean, we're talking about a guy who's been top 5, top 10, and even led the NBA in minutes. So as he gets older, I'd like to see him wrestle a few minutes down. I mean, obviously it's not going to happen. It typically doesn't with stars in the NBA. But when you can, it would be those games when the Blazers get out in front real early and get those wire-to-wire wins. It would be nice if Lillard isn't playing the entire fourth quarter.
Yeah, and this might be a legit thing. They've tried to do this before, but the Blazers have really been, during Lillard's tenure, a fourth-quarter team. Mm-hmm. You know, becoming a first-quarter team would give them a huge leg up, and I think would be a sign of their veteran experience that they're trying to develop, because they can do that. If they get the jump on the opponent and put him down, then that depth can work for them, because they can put in reasonably good players and still maintain that and give their guys a little bit more of a rest. The problem is, if they're still banking on being a fourth quarter team, if they're still slumping in the first half, then, you know, you feel pressure to keep playing Lillard and McCollum, to keep pace. And you think if you take them out, then you're going to get the deficit too big. And then it kind of snowballs, because then fewer people off the bench are playing. Then people are being misused or not used. And then all this depth, which is really kind of not really textural depth. It's not like there's people poking their heads above other people's. It's kind of a swamp after the starting guards. And that kind of depth can also foul your chemistry if somebody feels they're not being used right and there's not a strong argument to be playing the other guy in front of them.
Yeah, and that's something that you got to be careful with. And I think that's why Coach Stotts gave multiple players the shot at that starting three position. You saw Crabbe out there, you saw Turner out there, you saw Harkless out there, and he seemed to settle in on Harkless because of the familiarity and the success that they had. So I think we'll see a lot of that going forward. He'll continue tinkering, and really one of the big things that I really want to see the first, you know, couple weeks of the season is the Blazers during the preseason, their offense, they didn't really run set plays. It was, if you listen to what Coach Stotts in his interviews and the players, they were wanting basic flow offense to get the new guys familiar with it and not really show anything to any other NBA teams. Normally you'll see Stotts or Lillard or McCollum out there dictating play, but it was basically a freelance offense. Set a screen here, flare screen there, down pick here. And guys were just kind of reading, reacting. And it was really nice at times what we saw with the Clippers in the first quarter. Then we saw what happened in the second quarter when the guys that weren't as familiar with the system got in. It was kind of funky. So inserting and actually using the set plays and the set offense could be beneficial for the newer guys and how that second unit kind of comes together. So that's one other thing that I'm looking forward to.
Well, and the brain power on this team is pretty significant, and obviously the chemistry is pretty good. If there's any team that can run a read and react offense, and by the way, a lot of teams try this because, A, players like having that level of control, and even the coaches that don't like to give up that control understand that there's a certain benefit to letting their guys run and keeping the mystery in the offense, so to keep the defense off balance. There's nothing quite as fun as calling a play every time down the court and having the opponent read your fingers every time down the court and set up for it. So a lot of teams try this, but not a lot of teams can succeed with it on a steady diet because their players aren't smart enough. Their players aren't together enough, or it devolves into just, you know, garbage offense. I don't think the Blazers are in danger of that. And I think this is where not only their chemistry, but their mobility and interchangeability can really pay dividends, because they can hit from a lot of different places on the floor and they can get to a lot of different places on the floor, which is going to keep defenses off balance.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's going to be, you know, the hallmark of the season is how well Portland adjusts to how teams are playing them on a nightly basis and how effective they are at changing tempo, changing their motion, and how they go about executing their offense. Because everybody knows it's going to start with Lillard and McCollum, but it doesn't always necessarily finish with those guys. And that's what keeps everybody off balance.
Especially now, if you have Mo Harkless, if you have Al-Farouq Aminu, if you have Mason Plumlee in your front court, should you not be fast breaking? Should you not be running the floor every opportunity you get?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's another thing that really has come out of the preseason, and I've been ecstatic about one particular aspect, not just running, but Damian Lillard discovering how fantastic a lob is. We've had more alley-oop lob dunks in this preseason than we had probably all of last year from Damian Lillard, and that's not an exaggeration. I think he threw 13 all of last year. When I want to go back and look at the numbers, but he didn't, I mean, this is not something he did. He's thrown at least 7 or 8 that were successful, and he had a couple that were broken up. But that's another wrinkle in when you have to worry about a guy like Mason Plumlee when he rolls to the rim, because he's not going to create on his own. But if Lillard or McCollum is willing to throw that ball up there, Evan Turner is willing to throw that ball up there, and somebody's going to crash and go get it, that's a huge, huge wrinkle in the offense that Portland can utilize.
More high lobs than Mike Rice playing tennis on a Saturday morning. It's absolutely, that would be a fantastic wrinkle to the offense. You know who else would bring a fantastic wrinkle to the offense? And we shouldn't bring this up, but the topic came up in the last week so.
You couldn't possibly be talking about a guy who's the mid-range Jesus, right?
Yeah, your ex spouse there, who's finding out maybe that their new fling isn't as flingy as they thought. Yes, there's a lot of smoke, or no, I shouldn't say a lot. There's some smoke surrounding LaMarcus Aldridge. I happen to think that there was a small little campfire that everyone then gathered around with big oriental rugs and fanned into, you know, Smoke City. I don't see the Spurs giving up on him after 1 year.
That would be very unSpursian, but at the same token, I wouldn't put it past him. R.C. Buford is the most shrewd general manager in the league. Everybody can say Tim Duncan and David Robinson, but these guys have made moves that blew everybody away a couple different times, and they've been rewarded every single time.
Also most likely to be a character on Dukes of Hazzard, but we'll leave that alone. in any case, yeah, I mean, okay. So look, I wouldn't be shocked in a Spurs sense. I would just be shocked in a basketball sense, because they actually got Aldridge, as it turns out, with the new CBA increase, or, you know, and all that. They got Aldridge at a fairly reasonable price right now. Yes, you know, last year they made him the man, kind of. But as long as Tim Duncan was sitting on that team, as long as that team looked like vintage Spurs, and it did, that transfer of power was never going to be quite complete. I think this year the chance is there. I don't see them giving up on that. There's some rumor of friction between Aldridge and Kawhi Leonard, and, you know, the Damian Lillard thing redone. I will have to see it to believe it. I think they'd probably be crazy to move him. I don't see how they get as much value. But let's just pretend, Dan, that somehow Aldridge was on the move and somehow the rest of the NBA turned him down and San Antonio turned to Portland and say, we'll trade him back to you for a price that does not include Damian Lillard or CJ McCollum. Would you take him?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, in a heartbeat.
Any debate about that?
No. Anybody who says otherwise, everybody will say everybody's welcome to their opinion. You're wrong.
Yeah.
LaMarcus Prime, I mean, is he the absolute best he's ever been right now? No. Is he still an all-star, near all-star? Yes. You pair him with Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum, you have a true three-headed monster. You have your three-star team. There's no more questions about, do you have an inside-outside game? You have both. That LaMarcus Aldridge is probably one of the most criminally underrated defenders in the league. And that was something that was talked about when he got to San Antonio, and their defense was spectacular. Yes, they have Kawhi Leonard and Tim Duncan there, but there's a reason why they won. The Spurs don't take one-dimensional players and plug them into their starting lineup. That's not something they do.
Except at center. But anyway. So look, would you say Aldridge was more valuable than Portland's entire front court combined?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, would you call them up and say, you know, you can have any three of our front court players, any three of them, take your pick, and this will be a steal for us, because that's how I feel. I mean,
yeah. That's pretty much how I feel about it.
And for all the smack talked about him, I mean, it's all noise. If he came back, everybody would love him. And everybody would love what the Blazers looked like with him in the fold.
You could make the arguments about the chemistry and his relationship with Lillard and how that might affect things. And yeah, that would be a problem. And obviously, if this you know, scenario came down the pipe, Olshay would be running this past Lillard. There's no doubt about it. And if Lillard said no, then it's not happening. But if
how could he say no? I mean, that's
from a basketball sense, it makes perfect sense. Those two played off each other wonderfully. And there was no point in time where those two were on a team where they had that third guy that could create.
So, look, they don't have to like each other. They just have to like titles.
Yeah.
I mean, who cares? I mean, bury whatever hatchet wherever you need to stick it and go out and challenge for a championship.
And win.
Now, are the Warriors still better? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you're looking at it. If you're in a 7-game series with the Warriors, yeah, the Warriors are still going to be favored, but Portland stealing that is not out of the question.
Portland would be the team that was next.
Yeah.
I mean, and they call them poor man's Golden State right now. They're not really. People say, well, the Blazers match up pretty well with Golden State. They don't. Really, you know, like you said, it comes down to a 7-game series. Single game, sure, anything can happen. 7 games, that's still too big of an ask. I mean, especially with Durant in the fold.
Yeah, that's the key.
There, I mean, you might have the second best of every matchup, but the second best, it would be clearly defined. And by the way, if Steph Curry went down then, like he did in the Portland's last playoff series with them, and you've got McCollum, Lillard, and Aldridge, maybe a different story.
Yeah, I mean, you're still looking at a favored Golden State. That's not, don't anybody get that twisted. But a team that has LaMarcus Aldridge with CJ and Damian on either side of him, that's a dangerous, dangerous team.
There it is, Neil Olshay. Go get him. You know, there's also been some speculation, returning back to the top of the program in Utah, somebody, I mean, there hasn't been real speculation. Somebody floated the idea a few weeks ago, Derek Favors, that might be on the move because Lyles, I've got the right Trey there, right?
Yes.
Trey Lyles, you know, is fantastic and looks like he's going to be eating Favors' minutes. Is it possible that the Jazz trade Favors, and if you could get a hold of him, would he make as big of a difference?
He wouldn't make as big of a difference as LaMarcus because his game is little less offense, a little more defense. And by defense, I mean rebounding. He's a phenomenal rebounder. I don't see him as quite necessarily elevating to that level to where it would make a legitimate three-headed monster. It's close, but making that deal, I couldn't make that deal. But I can see Utah moving him. And that with the way Trey Lyles is playing and the way he's looked and the way the NBA has played today, Trey Lyles is a more valuable player than Derek Favors.
Favors, I think, would solidify the defense a little more. Mm-hmm. I mean, for all the Blazers talk about depth, I mean, that power forward thing is still sort of up in the air. Ask me if I'm a believer if Al-Farouq Aminu can play. I am. I believe he can play. Ask me if I believe he's a starter for a great team. It gets shakier. Ask me if I believe he's a starter at power forward.
Well, we saw the difference. You Blake Griffin in the playoffs last year, Al-Farouq Aminu got his number a couple times. Blake Griffin won a couple of matchups. A week ago, Blake Griffin won almost every matchup. He made a point of saying, Al-Farouq Aminu, you are not going to stop me in the post.
Yeah, and this is the issue I see, and I think it's something that Portland will have to resolve. I think in my article this week, one of them I wrote that Al-Farouq Aminu has the potential to be a stretch forward who can't stretch, and a good defender who can't defend the post against bigger men. And if other teams can exploit that, that power forward experiment may end fairly quickly.
Yeah, no, I think it'll last the long haul because the amount of guys in the league that can really bother you down the post has dwindled so drastically over the last 5 years. But the problem is when you do get matched up in those scenarios, guess what? You've got Draymond Greens. You've got LaMarcus Aldridge. You've got Blake Griffin. Remind me again what conference those guys are in.
Yeah, and which teams you're looking to knock off, by the way, to get through the playoffs. That's a problem. I mean, and can he go out on the perimeter against stretch fours? Yeah, I believe this is where shorter guys can excel because they can get in the shooting motion. I mean, a lot of those stretch fours, when they're out there, very few of them are keeping the ball high and very few of them are instant catch and shoot guys. So even though you're shorter, you can get your hand in their chest and you can mess up their stroke, something fierce. That said, if you do that with Aminu, he's staying home out there. Now that takes a big claw out of your defensive attack because he is the guy. He's the guy who anchored. He's the guy who went up against your opponent's best scorer and tried to shut him down. And he's not doing that anymore if he's out there against stretch fours. I just like him better, I think, at small forward. I know statistically I probably don't have an island to stand on there because he played power forward in Portland's best lineups, but
is burgeoned by having Maurice Harkless and Mason Plumlee. It's the fact that those three play together. It's because they can all move their feet. Aminu is good in space. Harkless is better in space. Plumlee obviously is the least effective in space. You move Aminu inside where he can be that help side defender, shot blocker, pester people, push people off their spots. That's where he's really successful. Harkless is the one that's really going to push out outside and put pressure on ball handlers, get in passing lanes, ignite the fast break. It's the triumvirate. It's the three of them together that really make that effective. If you take one out of the equation or you put them in a spot that they're not really comfortable in, that's when it starts to fall apart. And that's where Portland, it not necessarily teeters on the edge, but they play with fire on a nightly basis because you're not going to be able to put all three of those guys in their best possible position to succeed on every single possession. And that's where you sometimes see those breakdowns.
And God help you if your starting guards aren't scoring. I mean, if another team can take out one of the two guards, then that front court trio becomes a liability pretty quickly. That said, I think Portland is in a better position this year than they were when they started last year. Mm-hmm. That's inarguable. How much better? And I think we're getting to a point that's been a sticking point during many seasons, but it may come out in this one because the expectations are so up in the air about what success is for the Blazers this year and how high they can go. Is good enough for Portland, given their situation, good enough anymore? And that's really been the explanation for the past couple of years. I mean, given everything that happened, the injuries and what have you, given everything that happened, the departure of LaMarcus Aldridge, they did really well. You'll certainly be able to make that argument again this year, no doubt. They'll do really well considering they're Portland. Is that enough of a measure of success this year, or do we need to expect more?
It's kind of weird because of what happened last year. Because they made it to the second round of the playoffs, they did something they hadn't really done, you know, outside of the 1 year with LaMarcus. And I think that's changed expectations unfairly because they got ahead of themselves. When we talked, I don't know, about a month ago, you asked me what I saw for a win total. And I figured that Vegas would put it at 46.5. And they came out and said 46.5. And that's not to toot my own horn. I just think that's where they're at. That's the expectation. If you're a 50-win team, you're expected, I think, to go to the second round, right?
Yeah, more or less.
If you're quite there, though, I think that's where they see them at, is that they're a team that could make it there, but nobody's expecting them to.
I think, you know, if it breaks like it did last year and a lot of the contenders have serious injury problems and the Blazers stay healthy again, knock on wood, I think 50 wins is within reach.
Absolutely.
I think there's possible that there could be three, maybe even four teams in the West that exceed that. I think there'll be two for sure, obviously. And then I think there's room for more if wherever that dividing line is. If it's between the top two teams and the rest of the conference, then 50 would be quite an achievement. If the rest of the conference is sitting around 44 wins, well, somebody's going to win 50, and Portland is a decent candidate to do that. So I think it all depends on where things break. And this is why, you know, I cringe a little bit. I mean, yes, I get the conference finals goal that some people have put forward. I think that's admirable. At the same time, I still feel the Blazers are dependent on what happens around them more than they're able to go out there and wrest control of this season for themselves. And that characteristic defines good from great. The Blazers are good. They're probably going to be good again. I am not sure that the Blazers are great yet.
I think you hit it perfectly. If you're dependent and not dictating, that's the defining line. The Golden State Warriors and the Cleveland Cavaliers are dictating.
The Spurs. I mean, classic about it. I mean, everybody's like, the Spurs are in decline. The Spurs are old. The Spurs are whatever. They went out there every season and said, you can say whatever you want. We're going to take you. And they did.
They've
and
won 50 plus for, what, 20 years? Was it 19? This is, if they win 50 this year, it'll be 20 straight years?
You're like, that's
nuts.
That's 1,000 wins. I mean, that's just wrong.
I mean, if you really think about that, that's the difference, though, between dependent and dictating.
Yeah, it's the consistency and it's the ability to night in, night out, season in, season out, no matter what happens, we are who we are. And the Blazers, we don't know, and even they don't know who they are yet. They're hoping they know who they are. I think a couple players know who they are, and more importantly, they know who they're going to be. I don't think there's any doubt that Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum know they're going to be stars in this league. Whatever they are right now, they know, you know, 3 years from now or when the career's all said and done, they're going to look back and say, we were damn good. But as a team, they're not at that point yet, and I don't think that I think they're going to have a hard time getting exactly there this year. And that's not to say they can't win or even win a lot or even make the conference finals. But even if they do, they're still in the tier that's underneath the best. They're not yet the best.
Yeah, you know, and if they don't break through, like fully break through and embrace, you know, that 50-win team that ends up dictating, I don't see that as a failure. If they win 46, 47, 48 games, that's an improvement over last year, right?
Yeah.
Let's say the Western Conference is good and you don't have a bunch of injuries and Portland still wins 46, 47, 48 games. Are we really going to be disappointed with the way things turned out? A 2, 3, 4, 5 win improvement when the West is still a deep conference in year two of what was a total rebuild?
No, exactly. And I think, you know, even at, by the same token, 50 wins doesn't necessarily merit success. 50 wins don't just happen, obviously. You have to be good. But 50 wins can happen to a team that's good but not great in this conference as well.
Hello, Clippers. And
there you go, Zing. But I think the upshot is whatever happens this year, it's kind of – because of what happened last year, whatever happened this year is kind of like a free pass. This is a free roll season for the Blazers. Next year, when the reality of the luxury tax settles in, when they look at each other and go, yeah, you know, not only do we have this roster, this is the roster we're probably going to have for a while, the expectations get much greater. I think the only way expectations can be cemented this year, oddly enough, is the other way around. If the Blazers end up winning 41 and either get in the 8th seed and lose quickly or, God forbid, don't make the playoffs, I think at that point panic sets in because, whoa, what's going on here? We are luxury taxed and we're at the bottom of the playoff bracket. That's not okay. But I think anything short of that is just kind of a free roll. The Blazers have it under control. They're going to keep learning. And then next season, really the rubber will meet the road.
Yeah, and that's not a bad thing. If you've got this building block and you've got this plan for success that you've laid out and you're ahead, you know, in year two, that's a good thing. That doesn't mean you alter what your path was just because you exceeded expectations in year one. Still have to maintain a course and plan to get better and better and better to execute it all the way through to the end.
Could have done it if they'd gotten their hands on Hassan Whiteside. I mean, then
you can elevate expectations. Yes.
Yeah, we're in year four. There's no rebuild plan anymore. You're ready to go. But short of that, I mean, they're not rebuilding. That would be unfair to say. I think it lets several things off the hook as well. The expectations are higher than that, but the expectations are not so high for me that anything can happen this season that I can't forgive other than missing the playoffs.
Yeah, I think that's probably the bottom line. The Blazers, at bare minimum, save catastrophic injury, knock on wood, are a playoff team. Right. And that's not a bad thing. You have to start somewhere. You have to buy a ticket, so to speak, in order to get in.
Yep. So, get on the ride. Yeah. See what happens.
So if you make the playoffs and then you build that experience again, very rarely in any professional sport do you see a team that comes into the playoffs without real playoff experience and push deep or push for a title. So you've got to start somewhere.
Well, that said, spending eternity in the first round is not a good sign either.
No, that's the other side of that
coin. When you get stuck in the first round a lot, then you have a hard time getting out. And most teams that make it there don't end up really making it much farther. There's usually a jump after a first round appearance or two, and then you show your true colors. Blazers will need to do that, but this year isn't critical for it. And speaking of critical, we're running out of time. So it's critical that we say any last thoughts, Dan, on opening day?
To me, it's a good way to get an easy, not necessarily easy, it's the NBA. It's a good way to start the season against the Jazz team as a measuring stick to springboard going forward, because the first 5 or 6 games to start this season are not easy and you get a bunch on the road. So win that opening night home game, start off well, start the momentum early. That way you've got a little bit of room going forward. And that's really what I'm hoping to see is Portland come out like they did last season against the Pelicans and hopefully not have a second game let off like they did against the Suns.
The Jazz right now are a hurdle with one side of the bar broken.
Yeah.
So you should be able to clear that thing and get some momentum. We'll see what happens. We are excited. We hope you are too. Next time we talk to you, the season will be well underway. We thank you for joining us. Find us on iTunes, Stitcher, a bunch of places. Leave good reviews. And somebody, the only review we have on Stitcher, I think, is somebody was cranky about us being too negative, which is ironic because too negative review. So if you want to help us out with that, give us a slightly more balanced look. That would be fantastic. Either way, we're going to keep doing this. And for Dan Morang, I am Dave Deckard, and we will see you next week.
Absolutely. Take care, everybody.